Well, hi, hello, and welcome to Rethinking Aloud, a podcast from the Diocese of Leicester, going deeper into some of the big questions that present themselves to our faith. The current coronavirus pandemic raises lots of questions, not just for Christians, but for everyone. Some of them new questions that we haven't had to face before, some of them perhaps old questions that we're now facing in a new context. And in this episode, we're going to be thinking about one of those, a question that spans the ages, but that we're having to wrestle with anew. How can we say that God is all-powerful and all-loving when there's so much suffering around? The problem of pain. And I'm joined today by Andy Hartrop, Rector of Heather and Ibstock in Northwest Leicester, Steve Harvey, Associate Rector of Emmanuel Church in Loughborough, and Dr. Emma Haywood, a GP who also leads a mission-shaped community as a licensed pioneer in the diocese. And they're going to help us to think around those, let's be honest, sometimes tricky questions and that difficult challenge at times to our faith. So one of you can kick us off, Stephen. Where would you start from in trying to answer this apparent contradiction of a powerful and loving God who allows what often seems to be very random, arbitrary, and cruel suffering?
Well, it's a big question, obviously, and I'm glad you said, where would I start? Because it is just a beginning. I think a couple of preliminary things to say is just that, first, I'm really acutely aware that for many, this is a real issue which is faced by real people living real lives from the midst of real pain and sorrow. So this isn't just an abstract question, and an abstract response simply wouldn't cut it. So although a philosophical, intellectual response to that question might be valuable, I think what most people want in that situation is comfort rather than a lecture. They want a hope that they can live by rather than a glib, oversimplistic one-liner. And so as much as possible, that's kind of something I want to try and avoid. And I guess the second kind of preliminary thing is also just to say that there are different kinds of suffering. So John Lennox, for instance, highlights the difference between natural evil, things like earthquakes, diseases like COVID-19, and moral evil, things like genocide or sexual assault. And clearly moral evil is different in so much as it's something for which humans are directly responsible. It isn't random, as some suffering seems to be. However, it's also worth noting that the lines can sometimes get blurry. Indeed, I think there's been some research that's tentatively suggested that the coronavirus, while not directly a moral evil, may have been an indirect consequence of some of humanity's unhealthy relationship with the natural, and especially perhaps in this case, the animal world. So I guess those preliminary throat-clearing exercises aside, as you said, the question of God and suffering isn't a new one. The ancient Greek philosopher Epicurus, 3rd, 4th century BC, voiced the dilemma most memorably, saying if a God, and he's not talking about the Judeo-Christian God, he's talking about a God, generic, if a God were to be all-knowing, that is, he knows about our suffering, all-loving, that he cares about our suffering, and all-powerful, i.e. that he can do something about our suffering, then suffering wouldn't exist. And since it does, such a God cannot exist. Then the slight problem with his logic, though, is that you don't necessarily have to understand all of a God's ways in order to believe in them. I don't fully understand how my toaster works, but I still trust it will toast my bread in the morning. What I think is really interesting about the question is that it's only something that's gained traction as a stumbling block or a perceived stumbling block to faith since the Enlightenment, which assumed that everything in the world can be understood and controlled through reasons by means of science and technology. In contrast, however, the early Christians were never particularly bothered by the apparent contradiction between suffering and the existence of God. What seemed to matter most to them wasn't an explanation, but rather it was the means to go on in the midst of the suffering. Their response wasn't a doctoral dissertation, but seeking to become and be a community which was able to absorb and resist and transform the suffering until Jesus returns to fully and finally restore all things. And I think that leads us on to the final point I just want to make at this stage, which is that death is an intruder into God's world. It's not of God. In fact, the Bible calls death God's final enemy. God is rather the source of all life. And so death insofar as it exists, is an affront to God. And if you look at the biblical account of creation, suffering has no place in it. If you look at the biblical picture of the life of the world to come, the end game, the suffering has no place in it. Revelation 21 verse 4 says that God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. So we live in a broken and disordered world. This isn't the way God wants it to be, but it isn't the way that God will leave it. The world is headed toward renewal, toward restoration, toward a final mending that makes all the sad things we experience now come untrue. So I guess if you want an answer to the question, why doesn't God do something about the pain and suffering in the world? I think the closest that the Bible comes to a direct answer is that he already has in Jesus's life, death, resurrection, exaltation, and the pouring out of the Spirit. And I'm sure we'll get onto some of that a little bit later.
That's great. So I guess what you're saying is, or what you've clearly said is that suffering wasn't a part of God's original intention, nor is it the ultimate destination. And I guess what the Bible would offer is, it would say that all suffering and all pain is a consequence of sin and rebellion, and the way in which humanity's predisposition and propensity to turn away from God kind of leaves everything fundamentally disordered. But we'll get back to that one in a bit. Emma, was there anything you wanted to add or to place alongside that?
Yeah, I tend to agree with Steve, really, that suffering was not the way that God wanted the story to go, but that's where we find ourselves because of his commitment to free will. That was one of the sort of unintended consequences, really. So I tend to think of suffering occurring for a number of reasons. There is that sort of the natural suffering because we live in a broken or fallen world. But then there are the choices that we make which can harm ourselves and harm others. So if I drink far too much alcohol and wake up next morning with a bad headache, then you could say that my suffering is a direct consequence of my choices. But the majority of suffering seems to come from other people making bad choices and having an impact on others. But it gets rather complex, doesn't it? Because some people make their choices because they themselves have suffered at the hands of other people. And there's always the collateral damage. So if a drunk driver knocks me down in the street and I end up in hospital with a broken leg for 6 weeks, then not only am I suffering, but my family suffer because I'm not there with them. So some suffering comes as a result of our own sin. Sometimes it's a consequence of other people's sin, and sometimes it's sort of collateral damage. Some people have put it forward in the past that suffering can be God's instrument to teach us, but I think we'll perhaps come on to that a little bit later.
Yeah, I think we'll pick up a number of those things. That's really helpful. So in a sense, we've got, if you like, this eternal container within which we have to understand this, the original plan, God's creation, and the ultimate destination, the new creation, that time where we're told that suffering will cease, when every tear will be wiped from our eyes, no sickness, sadness, pain or dying. So we place our conversation within that really big context, and that's helpful. And we'll return to that again a little bit later. But I'm interested in this link. We've several times used that word, which gets used in churches and in theological conversation, but probably not much in everyday ordinary vernacular, that word sin. I'm interested in this link between suffering and sin because we need to be a bit careful here, don't we, Andy?
Yeah, we do need to be careful on this one. The Bible teaches plainly that suffering is not necessarily connected with someone's sin or wrongdoing. So the whole book of Job is a protest against that idea. And Jesus spoke very strongly against it also. So in Luke chapter 13, some cases are brought to him, some terrible things had happened. And Jesus said, "Do you think that these were worse sinners, more guilty? I tell you, no, he says very strongly. And then he does add as a warning to us, unless you repent, you too will all perish. So it's clear there's not that direct link. We cannot make that link. I suffered because of this particular sin. It's simply not the case. But in the bigger picture, yes, there is this teaching in Romans chapter 8 that the creation was subjected to frustration, this sense of futility, that creation has not achieved the goal for which it was designed. And why was that? Well, it's because of our choice as human beings to rebel against God. And so there's a reference there to this curse which God put on the ground because of the sin of the first human being. So then there's a fracturing of our relationship with God, and from that God decrees, well, there's going to be a fracturing then in the way the world is. God's very good creation became flawed and fractured. So those are two really important perspectives to hold together on this one.
Right. So sometimes suffering is a result of someone else's sin. You know, you punch me on the nose, I suffer. We were thinking about this earlier. Sometimes our own sin, destructive patterns of life and so on. Sometimes apparently just arbitrary, natural disasters, pandemics, or whatever. We've said that God's original plan and his ultimate purpose are suffering free. The questions remain why? You know, some of those why questions. Why does he allow it? You know, we often say God's in control, God's sovereign. But is he really? We'll think about that in a moment. But Emma, before we go any further, I'm very aware, and Steve spoke a bit about this right at the beginning of our conversation, but I'm very aware that you see suffering at the messy end in all of its grim realities, sometimes as a part of your job. I'm sure there are joys to being a GP as well, but mortality and some of the suffering is something which is going to be a part of your everyday. Do you just want to say something or kind of reinforce what Steve said about the pastoral side of all of this?
Yeah, well, I'd actually say that the opportunity to be present at people's moment of need is one of the huge mm-hmm. privileges of my calling as a GP. And I'm sure that people in ordained ministry find a similar thing. But perhaps the difference between me working in a GP surgery and a vicar working from a church is that the majority of people that I see who are suffering for all sorts of different reasons is that most of the people that I speak with do not have the hope of eternal life because they do not yet know Jesus. And can you imagine what it's like to suffer without the hope that we have, no hope of forgiveness for things that we've messed up in? No hope of reconciliation, no hope of life beyond the grave. The suffering that I see often is more than just the physical or emotional or mental difficulty, but it actually is a spiritual suffering. As a GP, I'm able to sit with people and allow them space to think and to talk about what they're going through. And sometimes that's the most effective thing, is just listening and holding that pain. Sometimes I'm able to speak words of hope, so challenging false beliefs about how they see themselves, for example, and just letting them know that actually I see them as a valuable and important person. But what I'm not allowed to do as a GP is to tell them what I know to be true, which is that Jesus is the answer to their fears, their broken dreams, and the huge holes that they have in their lives. And this is where it's so important for the church to get involved with the messy end, because you have permission outside of a medical context to actually say, well, let me tell you about Jesus. He's interested in your suffering. He wants to reach down into it and to help you out. I led a bit of training for some ordinands not so long ago. But it was really interesting to me, because I was hoping that as sort of ordained ministers or soon to be ordained ministers, their response to scenarios I gave them where people were suffering would be, well, Jesus is the answer. But actually, it was more commonly they were sort of taking the social approach and thinking, well, what could we practically do to help? And I think that's a real challenge for the church, is to be real about actually it's Jesus who brings hope. It's Jesus who will give you life that goes beyond the grave. And it's Jesus we need to be speaking about. But that's not something I can do in a medical context, however much I believe that that truly is the answer to people's problems.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. And you're right. The Jesus aspect is what we as church uniquely have to bring into this situation. And so while I absolutely think it's important sometimes that we're just there, that we're present with people, that we're perhaps holding someone's hand and talking to them and assuring them by our physical presence of our that we're there for them. I think even if they're not looking for that esoteric philosophical answer or, you know, 15 reasons why it makes sense to believe in God while they're suffering, I think what we do offer is that thing of saying, look, I believe God's in this with you. Would you rather go through this on your own, or do you want to go through it with the presence of God with you? You know, can I pray with you? Can I pray for you? And some of those things are what we uniquely have to offer. And there is a unique hope, I would suggest, that only the Christian has. You know, that eternal perspective on things and that knowledge that Christian peace isn't always the absence of trouble, but it is always about the presence of God with us in our troubles. So back to that thing about God being in charge, is he? And how does suffering fit in with the idea that we sometimes speak of? And I think we've perhaps touched on this, and we may actually even have sort of slightly different perspectives on it amongst those of us who are talking at the moment. But yeah, we sometimes speak of God's will. And here's the question, is it God's will for people to suffer? Stephen, do you want to have a go at that one first?
Well, if I can, I'll just give a kind of quick, simple answer and then kind of explain a little bit more what I mean by that. So is God in charge? Yes, absolutely. Does that mean that God likes to see us suffer? No, absolutely not. So perhaps I could just give you a little example. I know it's imperfect, as every example is. But during the last few weeks of lockdown, two of my kids have learned to ride their bikes without stabilizers. As other parents will know, there's a moment when your child is learning to ride a bike that you have to stop holding the back of their seat and either let them ride or let them fall. Scraped knees, bumped elbows are almost inevitable. Does that mean that I want to see my kids get hurt? No, absolutely not. But I'd sought to establish kind of safe perimeters within which those risks could be taken. Was it my will that they get hurt? No. It was my will, my hope for them, that they would ride their bikes confidently, and they have. And so my take on the biblical narrative is that God actually wills us to have a will. Often we think of God's will a little bit like catching a train at the platform. If we miss it, we're done for. There's not another one coming. In reality, I think it's probably best understood as the bearing on a compass. It's more like a trajectory or a point, a direction of travel. I think God's far more interested in the kinds of people we're becoming than single events or single choices. And I think this really taps into something else, which is that God has a rather different idea of power, of what it means to be in control, than we do. We tend to think of power as the ability to get stuff done. But the Apostle Paul, writing to the Corinthians, says that the power of God is definitively displayed at the cross. Where was the power of God strong enough to defeat sin, to defeat death once and for all? The cross, the ultimate place of weakness and suffering. And I love the way that Tim Keller puts it, summarizes it. He says that the ultimate triumph of good over evil is that now when evil happens, God uses it for good, not that it's God. It's what Paul says in the letter to the Romans. We know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him. And I've experienced this personally as well. So about 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with testicular cancer, and it was an awful experience. It was really painful. But it was also one of the most fruitful times of personal and spiritual growth. I don't think that makes the cancer a good thing, but I think it's more a case that God's will prevailed through it, and he turned it to good.
So a bit like Joseph, when he meets with his brothers and he says, "You meant it for ill, but God meant it for good."
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And do you think, and I'll come on to Andy in a second, see, but do you think that means that God, in a sense, is more reactive than proactive? Or is that actually artificially putting the wrong categories on the conversation?
Oh, goodness. I mean, there's a big kind of theological debate about something called the mutability of God. Does God change? Is he influenced by outside factors? I'm particularly struck by something that the great Swiss theologian of the last century, Karl Barth, said, which is that God is unchanging as the living God, and in the mercy which he espouses, the cause of the creature. In other words, God doesn't conform to our ideas of what God ought to be like. He responds to us. He reacts to us freely in his own desire. So he is reactive and responsive, but that doesn't in any way detract from his sovereignty, because he chooses it, he wills it, if that sort of makes some kind of sense.
Yeah, and there's a lovely theological word, isn't there, that describes that kind of apparent paradox. I think the word is antinomy. And two things which seem almost impossible to reconcile, but in the bigness of God, they make sense. Andy, anything you want to say?
Yeah, I mean, people do ask this question, and quite rightly, is it God's will for people to suffer? And, you know, Steve's made some great points there. I think just another angle on this is just to think for a moment about pain. In a very ordinary way, I think it's fair to say that not all pain is bad. You know, pain has a role in warning us of danger. If we're getting dangerously close to a fire, you know, we sense that and we could pull back. Pain and kind of hardship can be useful in trying to get more physically fit or mentally fit. You know, no pain, no gain. And we recognise that. And you know, in ordinary life, we can see that as we go through tough times, actually it can build our character and our fortitude. So at least in this world, we can see that some pain is okay and it's useful. It's not all bad. So I think that's worth saying. But in the bigger picture, and I think one of us already touched on this, the idea that, you know, this world is disordered. I think a good word, especially, is the word fractured. If we go back to the sin of the first human being against God, and God said that he was going to subject creation then to frustration or a kind of futility. We see that in Romans chapter 8. So God's will is that's how it is now, and that's a warning to us that things are not fully right in the world because we're not right with God. And I think the word fracturing is quite a helpful word, and it does link closely to coronaviruses. Let me try and explain, give an example from a scientist from Australia, Peter Pollard, who's an aquatic microbial ecologist. He says there are 21 viral types that wreak havoc with the human body. Coronavirus is one of those. But he says these are an insignificant fraction of the 100 million viral types on Earth. Most viruses are actually vital to our existence. The sheer number of these, quote, good, unquote, viruses is astonishing. It's the combination of high bacterial growth and viral infection that keeps ecosystems functioning. They are a critical part of inorganic nutrient recycling. So these amazing things in the world that still work so well, such as all we're discovering about these good viruses. But there are things that have gone wrong. The world is fractured. And I think that's why the Christian worldview helps to make good sense of the world that we know, even though we only see in a very limited way. I think also helps us think about, no, God doesn't specifically plan or drop wicked things on particular people. That's simply not the case. It's the bigger picture. The world has gone wrong, and that is in turn is a warning sign. Its intended part is a warning sign to help us think we need to get back into a right relationship with God.
That's interesting. So in different ways, Andy and Steve have both kind of picked up on that thing, kind of, I suppose, the transformative effect that suffering can sometimes happen. I think it was Steve when he shared about his cancer diagnosis a few years ago and saying how that was a period of growth. And then some of the stuff Andy's just said there as well. So people will often say everything happens for a reason, or suffering happens for a reason. And in one sense, again, they could be fitting that, if they're Christians, into that big, broad context of God's ultimate will and the Christian's eternal destination. But often I think when people talk in those terms, they're talking about the transformative effect of suffering in life, kind of in the here and now. What do you think about that, Emma?
Well, personally, I don't think that God sends us suffering to teach us, but I do believe that our God is a redeeming God. So what do I mean by that? Well, I mean that he can look at the heap of misery and suffering, you know, like a great big pile of muck, and he can reach down into that and bring forth gold. So he can redeem even terrible situations and bring things. We need suffering to do good things in our lives. But just because there is suffering doesn't mean to say that he's not going to do anything good at all. And I also think that he's given us all the resources and to mitigate for suffering. So you've mentioned already some of the things in the natural world. The medicines I prescribe are mainly derived from things that exist within creation, which, of course, God put there. But not only that, the natural resources, but he's created humankind in his own image, which includes the capacity for compassion and care. And so actually, by reflecting that part of him in my work in the NHS, I'm part of God restoring people in a small way when they come to me in the midst of pain and suffering as well. So he's a redeeming God and he's a mitigating God. On a bigger scale, I remember reading in the British Medical Association newsletter soon after the London bombings, and just reading their account and thinking, my goodness, God was really involved there, because it so happened that the bus bomb blew up just outside the BMA headquarters. And one of the first people out the building was one of the most highly qualified first responders in the country. Just there for a meeting. You wouldn't necessarily have predicted that. But wasn't it a good thing that he was there to help deal really swiftly and efficiently with the injured? On the other side of the city, where the helicopter emergency medical service, HEMS, was based, they had something like four times the usual number of doctors present, because they were all in the building for an audit meeting, which meant that the helicopter could fly and collect the injured and take them to the hospitals really quickly without the need to call people in from home. So God knew that that was going to happen, and he put things in place to mitigate against the suffering. So I like to think of him as actually sort of putting the brakes on, that suffering would be so much more and more out of control if he wasn't able to intervene in his kindness to mitigate against it.
Thank you. Andy, anything to say on that one?
Yeah, really helpful what Emma's just said, and that's a fabulous example, you know, from those awful London bombings. And I think that Paul's teaching in Romans 5 is very helpful at this point as well, where he says some very striking things about suffering, that we rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. Not only so, we also rejoice in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance produces character. We might call that stickability. And character produces hope, great confidence. So God can does use suffering and hardships in these transformative ways. But I think that's very different from saying that the suffering happens for that reason. I think we can say that God permits it, and in permitting it, God has a purpose. It could have been otherwise, but God permits it. But that's different from saying this has happened specifically for that purpose. So I think that's an important distinction. If you say it specifically for that purpose, that can be really unhelpful. And I see danger of God, some kind of awful kind of demagogue figure, just dealing out horrible stuff to test us and try us. And I don't think that's true to the Bible. So we say that suffering and hardships are sadly part of this fractured world, but God can and does use them to make us more like Jesus. And that's my experience from various hardships in my life. And many times I've cried out to God, why are you allowing these things to happen? But then looking back later, you can see it actually helped me depend more on him. It helped me to be more patient, to stick it out. So there are mysteries here as well, how these things kind of fit together, God's purpose, what he permits, our own choices. Well, I'm happy to relax in God's greatness and goodness and trust his love and that he is God and he is in charge.
And I think that's, again, that's useful, isn't it? That sense of, with all of these big questions, we need to approach them with that sense of humility that says, I'm a finite human being with a finite capacity to understand, and I'm trying here to comprehend in some way an infinite God, you know, whose ways aren't my ways and who's so much bigger even than my ability to attempt to understand what he's like. I mean, I think of C.S. Lewis, who said, God whispers in our happiness, talks to us in our conscience, and shouts in our pain. And C.S. Lewis used to draw have this analogy of drawing and saying that if a child did a sort of simple doodle and you then compared it to some great artist working on what they hoped would be the masterpiece that was their artistic legacy, the small child's drawing might have been done in seconds, just a few little lines on the paper, and that was it. If the painting of the great artist's masterpiece was sentient, it would probably at times wish it was the child's simple painting, because it would have been scraped at and rubbed away and, you know, worked on and all the rest of it. But ultimately you get a masterpiece. And C.S. Lewis was sort of putting forward the idea that actually it's through some of those things that are difficult and that seem so hard to go through at the time, that God might create out of us the masterpiece who he wants us to be. But again, it's worth mentioning even then, though, that C.S. Lewis went around lecturing on theology, and he had this series of radio talks that he did in the early 1940s that got turned into a book called Mere Christianity that has never been out of print since, and all the rest of it. He had it all there in his head and he could explain it. But when he went through his own suffering journey, when his wife died of cancer, it really rocked him. And he wrote about that in a book called A Grief Observed, and kind of looked at his own suffering journey, and he did emerge from it with a strong faith, but at times it really wobbled. And I think it's worth reminding ourselves that some of these answers can sound quite glib, but actually when you're in the middle of the pain, it's okay to shout at God, it's okay to ask the why question, and it's okay to not be okay. That thing about God shouting in our pain, I think that can be useful. Moving into a different place, the theologian N.T. Wright recently made much of the fact that God suffers. He was talking about coronavirus, and that was a big thing for him, the fact that God suffers, that Jesus wept at Lazarus's grave, even though he knew he was about to raise Lazarus from the dead. The kind of the pathos, the sadness of the situation overcame him. And God, the Christian God, isn't a God who's remote and detached. You know, he suffers with us. Jesus is described in Scripture as a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. So how does that knowledge, that type of thinking, how does that affect how we understand and experience suffering? I mean, does God suffer? And if he does, what difference does that make for us?
Well, I think you've already mentioned it, that we have to look at who God is through the lens of Jesus. That's the way that the Bible encourages us to see God. The beginning of John's Gospel says that Jesus is the only Son, is the one who makes God known. And one of the names, of course, that we speak of Jesus, especially around Christmas time, is that he's Emmanuel, God with us. And that does mean God with us in our human life and in the fullness of human life with all its ups and its downs. I remember something Eugene Peterson once said, which was that the Bible neither explains nor eliminates suffering. Rather, what it does is show us God entering into the life of suffering humanity, accepting it, sharing it, making it his own. So I don't think that God gives us a simple, straightforward answer to the question of suffering, but he does point us to some clues as to the answer. And I think that passage, that story of Jesus with Lazarus is a wonderful one. And again, one that comes to my mind is Jesus healing a man with leprosy, and that man with leprosy comes right up to Jesus, asks him to heal him. And what Jesus does next is really striking. Not only does he heal the man, but he heals the man by touching him, something which would have been completely unthinkable. In other words, Jesus heals the man by risking self-contamination, by getting involved in the man's suffering in a physical, tangible, intimate kind of way. And I think that's, a picture of what God does with us in Jesus. He gets involved in the life of the world and is transforming it from the inside out. And I think that's also something that really makes the claims of Christianity unique. Christianity is the only world faith that contends that the infinite God condescended by taking the form of our finitude in becoming fully human. Lots of people have written on the suffering of God. I think one of the most famous is the German theologian Jürgen Moltmann, who wrote a book called The Crucified God. I think if we take seriously the doctrine of the incarnation, that Jesus is God in the flesh, and that this same Jesus uttered at the cross the words, my God, why have you forsaken me? Then we're left with very few possibilities except to say that, yes, God is with us, even in our sufferings. And that's an enormous help, enormous comfort for those who are going through it, which I think, as we've highlighted a few times, is actually what is at the heart of this question, because it is about people's experience of suffering. It's not just an intellectual exercise, but that even in the midst of our suffering, we can be in communion with the eternal God who in Jesus Christ suffered with us and for us. That's just a breathtaking thing to be able to know and experience in the middle of that situation.
And that sort of condescension of God in Jesus to sort of join in with our life, become one of us, it's beautifully picked up, isn't it, at the beginning of chapter 2 of Philippians, where Paul quotes one guesses a hymn or kind of a poem that was used at the time, but talks about Jesus humbling himself, not only becoming human but dying on a cross, but then ultimately how that suffering journey for Jesus is the journey towards his glorification. And the same is true of us, that actually as we pass through suffering and through this life, that's also the ticket to our future eternal glory. And thinking about that, this conversation coming to the cross, we're still in the Easter season. How does the idea of resurrection and eternal life alter our perspective, Andy?
I think there are two massively important things to say about this. And the second one connects back more to the cross, and I'll come to that in a moment. But the first thing is quite a surprising thing about the resurrection, I think. And this is, there's lots of times in the book of Acts this is hinted at, but especially when the Apostle Paul is in Athens talking to his audience, and he tells them that Jesus has been raised from the dead And this shows that God has appointed him, Jesus, judge of the world. That the risen and ascended Jesus is going to judge the world. So there is a justice. You know, there are many things in life that we all know are wrong. We know that things aren't right, even apart from the coronavirus, just all sorts of other things that we do to one another, the wickedness, and if we're honest, if we look in the mirror in our own hearts and lives. But to know that there is a judge, there is coming that final, complete day of judgment, that can be a tremendous support and encouragement to us. We cry for this justice, and God is saying, yeah, I'm going to do that. And the resurrection of Jesus demonstrates that. So that's a remarkable thing. But all those who are yearning for justice and saying, well, God, is God really just? Is he really that bothered? The big answer is yes. Jesus' resurrection proves it. But along at the same time, of course, as I say, that means we've got to look in the mirror. That must alert each of us to our own shortcomings, our own guilt, and how we're going to get right with God. So that's the big thing from the resurrection. But I think the second thing is, and this ties back to the cross that we were thinking about just a little while ago, that Jesus was a man of sorrows, that he suffered. But that he didn't just suffer only as an example, that's true, yes. But he suffered for us, in place of us, and he did it because he loved us. He did it because he wanted to rescue us from the terrible mess that we got into. So Jesus died, he took the penalty and the guilt that you and I deserved. And the resurrection then proves that the price was paid, absolutely 100% paid. And so if we repent and trust Jesus as Lord, then we can know the wonderful things. But it's all because of the cross and the resurrection. We can know total forgiveness. We can know peace with God our Maker. We can know a new life now with new strength to live. And we've got this amazing promise of a new world, a new creation where suffering will be no more. So this God has come to us. He's come as one of us. He's come to love us and demonstrating it. And so if people say, well, how can I trust that God really loves me? Then look at Jesus. This is the God who truly we can trust. He's become one of us. He suffered for us. And so we can reach our hand out to him in faith and know that relationship and know his peace and all these marvellous things that he's come to bring. So Easter season is a great time to be considering these hardships, these real questions of pain and suffering that so many are facing, but with real answers for everybody.
And of course, Scripture presents Jesus' resurrection as it's described as the first fruits of our own, almost like the guarantee of ours. It's like God saying, I've raised my son from the dead. I can do it for you. You know, I can do this thing. And that's our guarantee, the proof that we can trust God, not only with our life, but with our death, because we know what lays beyond it in terms of the new creation and a future, an eternal future with him. We haven't really talked about prayer at all, which is a bit of a weird thing, isn't it? Where does prayer fit into all of this, Emma?
Well, where doesn't prayer fit into all of this, I suppose, would be the other way of putting the question, wouldn't it? It's interesting, isn't it, that I was reading earlier on that during this time of pandemic and lockdown, that people are crying out to God, and that there has been, you know, a huge number of hits on the 24/7 prayer website. And certainly in our church, we saw more people than ever before commit to praying for an hour or more within our 24/7 prayer week. So I think it's true that when we encounter suffering, we do tend to cry out in the same way as if one of my children falls over and hurts themselves. They come crying and running back in, asking for mummy or daddy to comfort them and to try and make things better. So prayer is everywhere. It's a kind of a natural reflex and response for many people. It's suffering can be the trigger for people who don't know God to start asking where he is. It makes them realize that perhaps there is more than just the physical reality around them. And of course, prayer can be a huge support for people who have questions that don't have ready answers. I don't know why things happen to my patients. I don't have a medical answer for that. But yet, even when there aren't answers, knowing that somebody has prayed for you when you're going through something can be hugely powerful, whether or not you believe in a God that answers prayer. And certainly in time of the pandemic, also we are seeing answered prayer. So it's not just a crutch or an emotional support to be prayerful at this time, but actually we're seeing people saved and delivered from their suffering. I don't know if you heard the testimony of Pastor Lee, who was the one who was on social media telling his story of God sending a cleaner when he was really poorly in hospital with COVID, and he just had this desire for some prawn cocktail crisps, amongst other things, and God sent a cleaner to encourage him, but also with some prawn cocktail crisps. So prayer is everywhere in this, and prayer is part of that dynamic relationship with God that we enjoy. And I think it's a wonderful opportunity in many ways for people to enter into that relationship or to enjoy it more fully and more intimately in these difficult times.
I think it's good to add as well to what Emma said there so beautifully, that God gives us in the Bible some great prayers to pray in different kind of circumstances and when things are going well, things are going badly. So in the Psalms especially, people cry out to God. And so we are encouraged to do that. And if people aren't too sure, what can I pray to God? Is it okay to complain and say why? Well, read the Psalms and you'll see that it is. And God gives us words that perhaps we couldn't find for ourselves, but to bring in our relationship with him, to bring our need, Lord, to cry out to him. And through that, we can be lifted, and partly to think of others and to pray for them. But that becomes a living, vital, a life-giving relationship. So prayer is absolutely crucial in all of this.
Mm-hmm. So some of the ground that we've covered in this conversation, suffering isn't part of God's original plan. It's not the final destination. Yeah, that kind of eternal perspective thing. We've thought about how sometimes retrospectively we can see where we've grown or how things have all worked together for good, that phrase from Romans, through suffering. We've thought about prayer, kicked around a little bit the question of how actively God does or doesn't plan things. That could take us into a whole complicated sovereignty of God stroke open theism discussion. We'll leave that for the experts, or at least for another day. But just wondering, as we draw towards a close, is there anything else that any of you would want to add to the conversation or think would be helpful? Just to bring in at this stage.
I think the wonderful thing is that we have a story of hope that we can share with the world. And actually, the current times that we're living in is giving us opportunity to tell that story to people who perhaps are more ready to hear it now than ever before. So I think this is a time when we're being called as a church to wake up and to speak up and to get involved and to be talking to people about the hope we have in Jesus and getting that message out there loud and clear. Because ultimately that is going to be the resolution for people's suffering if they know that they're forgiven by Jesus and that they will spend eternity with him.
I think what I'd like to add at the end is just really saying, as we began, that for many people this isn't just an abstract intellectual question. It's coming from a place of felt pain, felt suffering, and again, as Emma said right at the beginning of our conversation, the answer is really to be found in a relationship with Jesus, and so if anyone's listening to this and they are wanting to find out how can they cope, how can they make sense of the suffering, of the pain, the hardship they're experiencing, well, I'd just encourage you to to consider the claims of Jesus, the person of Jesus. I know a number of churches at this time are holding online Alpha courses or online Christianity Explored courses or ways of interacting with others, asking some of these big questions and seeking to find out a little bit more about what the Christian faith has to say about them. So if you're in that number, I would just encourage you, take the time, take the opportunity to explore Jesus and how faith in him can give you the resources to not only survive suffering, but to even thrive through it.
Thank you. Well, we're coming towards the end now. These podcast conversations are very much entered into by the panelists in the hope that the conversation will continue when the podcast ends in your own churches, Fresh Expressions, deaneries, small groups, home groups, you know, through Zoom or Skype or however you're keeping in touch. So here are a few questions that you might want to use in those conversations as we look to think about our everyday faith and how it connects with our and other people's everyday lives. So here are some questions you might want to discuss in your groups. How satisfactory do you find the approaches to suffering that were spoken about in the podcast today? What Bible passages or stories help inform your understanding of suffering? Where have you experienced suffering as a catalyst to growth in your Christian life? How are you or how is your church responding in love to the current crisis? What difference does it make that Jesus himself suffered? And how might you more intentionally and creatively pray for a suffering world? Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Rethinking Aloud. Next week, our subject is What About the Eucharist? And I'll be joined by two vicars, a theological educator and a deanery lay chairperson, all of which sounds like it could be the opening line to a not very funny joke, but it's not. But we'll be back next week thinking and talking, and we hope that you'll join us again then. My thanks to today's panel, to Andy, to Emma and to Steve. And please go safely, be blessed and do join us again.